I've struggled a lot in the last couple of weeks getting to this Martin Luther King Day, this Martin Luther King Sunday, and I've struggled more than usual. That's because the events in the news in the months leading up to today make it a very different day. They are obvious moments of conscience calling out, saying this is not right, saying in the reading we ought to be maladjusted. They call for us to take a position. That's also because it happened that this month's theme is integrity. What does it mean to be a people of integrity? And every time I come up to a social issue, and you'll see it next week when we talk about climate change, I'm confronted by this theme, but I don't really hold it in front of me like that. What does it mean to be a people of integrity? What does it mean to have everything be of a piece? What does it mean not to just be entertained by stirring words, but committed to action that is of a piece and might become integral in my life, not just nodded to once a year? Goody, is this mic on? Would you turn off the pulpit mic? Okay, good. It's ringing in my head. So the question, it still is, of how might we stay engaged is with me all the time. We know the saying, the arc of the moral universe is long and it bends towards justice. We credit that to Martin Luther King Jr., but it was originally written by Theodore Parker, Unitarian abolitionist minister. What are the key words in there? We gloss over what we read a lot, but the key words are arc. It's not a straight line. It's an arc. The next word is long. Long. And then it's bends. Gradually sort of moves towards justice. And then in our reading, Howard Thurman says, keep fresh before me the moments of my high resolve, big resolve. I started thinking about that. What are those moments? They're really those moments where you're moved by love, but let's step back and reframe it and reframe the focus from high resolve. My day-to-day life doesn't have a lot of room for high resolve. You know, it's more, how do I just keep going? And so what if I reframe the focus from high resolve to find or look for sustainable resolve for me? Something that may have a chance of resurfacing, that has a chance of integrity, becoming a part of my life and life, so I might keep fresh my care. You think about, many of you were here for the first service of January where we made paper. Remember that? The paper, we wrote our, what did we write? Our good intentions, our resolutions, our resolve on paper. And then we worded up in a blender and filtered it out. And we took home pieces of paper. And in a way, that's the support of all of us in our high resolve or our resolutions, our resolve to do, as Vicky said, the right thing. But it's also our good intent. But I thought about it too, the way it gets blended up. It's also the way our resolutions, our resolve, gets blended up into little pieces. Yeah, we think about it during the day, but what does it become? But we have these pieces where we've said, as a community, we're going to put our good intentions in front of us. My other piece, I have a couple of these now, extras, if anybody needs one, is on my refrigerator. So before me, when I open to get my food that sustains me, is these moments. So there are three sections today that I thought about that make this different. One is historical, one is current, and then the other section is how do we respond with integrity? What is a way to think about that that's different? The first historical piece Vicki alluded to, we know that this is the 50th anniversary of what has been called the March on Selma, right? It's the 7th of March, really, was when Martin Luther King and many others approached the Edward Pettus Bridge in Selma, and it was in support of the Voting Rights Act, or passing Voting Rights Act, and they were turned back by dogs and hoses and troopers, state troopers, and they'd also marched there because in February, civil rights worker Jimmie Lee Jackson had been killed by an Alabama state trooper, and they were protesting that. But they were turned back from the bridge, and at that point, Martin Luther King sent out a telegram to ministers, to congregations, to people of faith, to come and stand with them. And I think back, it was a telegram that he sent. Well, hundreds of ministers in the Boston area, and many of them Unitarian Universalists at that time, 1965, got on planes and flew down to participate in the march. One of those was James Reeb, who had been a minister at All Souls Church in Washington, D.C., but was now working for the American Friends Service Committee. He had four young children, and he decided to get on the plane and fly down. They were turned back from the bridge again that night. They were eating at a local restaurant, and many of them got in cars then to drive to a gathering that Martin Luther King was leading. But James Reeb and Orloff Miller and Clark Olson, who lives in Asheville, many of you know Clark, decided to walk to the meeting. James Reeb was the closest person to the street. They were attacked by four or five, they don't know how many, white men. One of them had a big stick, and he swung it and hit James Reeb in the head, 1965. He couldn't get a car to take him to the hospital. The closest hospital with a neurosurgeon was in Birmingham. There's a long story around that. Anyway, 2 days later, James Reeb died. So that's something to remember as a history piece. Martin Luther King was asked by Lyndon Johnson to come back to help with the passage of the Voting Rights Act, which Johnson had submitted after Reeb was hurt and then after he died. But Martin Luther King stayed to deliver the eulogy. And he said something, and it's paraphrased, but so in his death, James Reeb says something to each of us, black and white alike. It says that we must substitute courage for caution, says to us that we must be concerned not merely about who murdered him, but about the system, the way of life, the philosophy that produced the murder. His death says to us that we must work passionately, unrelentingly, to make the American dream a reality so that he did not die in vain. The history. And here we are with the movie. And now we are 50 years from that time and later, and so much is different. The arc bends towards justice, and yet so much that needs our conscience and resolve is still there. In August, our attention was drawn to the killing of an unarmed black man, Michael Brown, in Ferguson, Missouri, by a police officer. Then there was the death of Eric Garner in New York City. And in the January 12th New Yorker, David Remnick begins his column, The Fire This Time, by quoting from a 1960 essay by James Baldwin titled Fifth Avenue, Uptown, A Letter from Harlem. It's the neighborhood where Baldwin grew up, but hear the language. Rare indeed is the Harlem citizen, from the most circumspect church member to the most shiftless adolescent, who does not have a long tale to tell of police incompetence, injustice, or brutality. I myself have witnessed or endured it more than once. Then he says, it is hard, on the other hand, to blame the policeman for being such a perfect representative of the people he served. He too believes in good intentions and is astounded and offended when they are not taken for the deed. Remnick goes on to say that that may seem a relic of a harsh past. It predates so many advances, including the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act. The New York City Police Department's rank and file now has more people of color. Crime rates are lower than they have been in decades. An African American was elected president in 2008 and appointed an African American to be the chief law enforcement official in the land. American audiences go to see Selma, get teary-eyed, and think how far we've come. The temptation is to suppose that Baldwin has long since lost all relevance. Why then does the president gently remind us that if he had a son, he'd look like Trayvon Martin? Why does the attorney general say we are a nation of cowards when it comes to the discussion of race? And then he goes on to tell about Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York and what he said just about his son. He said he and his wife have had the conversation with him about the dangers he may face on the street as a young man of color. He goes on to talk about the worry, is my child safe? Not only from the people on the street, but from the people who would protect him. De Blasio then echoed one of the most resonant lines heard since the protest began last summer in Ferguson, Missouri. He says, it's a phrase that should never have to be said. It should be self-evident, but our history sadly requires us to say that Black lives matter. The demonstrations that followed were almost entirely peaceful. At that press conference, de Blasio, Remnick said, had referred to a history that preceded the death of Eric Garner and charged it with meaning. The story of civil rights is not an event that ends with a triumphal arrival at a Southern state house. The story of civil rights is not an event that ends with a triumphal arrival at a Southern state house. Two generations after Selma, the Supreme Court has started to roll back voting rights. Two generations after Selma, one out of three Black males born in America today will, if present trends continue, see the inside of a prison cell. Take a moment and just count off three, and every third person raise your hand. Just do that real quick. Just raise your hand. Every third person, roughly, raise your hand. Look around the room. It turns out that 24 out of 25 of New York NYPD officers of color who were interviewed by Reuters have experienced stop and search, police harassment when they are off duty as men of color in the streets. Remnick goes on to talk about James Baldwin, and he says, some of the language is of its time, but the demand is everlasting. It goes on and on. Michael Greenberg has an essay, The New York Police Versus the Mayor, and he ends it with the line, it would be a tragedy of the movement for racial justice that began in Ferguson last August to die. Two New York City police or New York Police Department officers, Rafael Ramos and Wenjin Liu, were shot, murdered by a person who, because of social media, could claim that it was in protest. But what he points out in the article is that policing has become a civil rights issue. He goes on to say, despite the strident rhetoric of the police, what was that, Lynch's position. Anyway, he's the Police Benevolent Association, I think, director, and his followers. Cops have been respectful of peaceful protesters, and this does not appear likely to change. But history shows us that we can get distracted and drop these issues. It would be a tragedy if the movement for racial justice that began in Ferguson last August were allowed to die. We get that. But how do we avert such a tragedy? How do we help it not happen? I'm your minister, and I don't know. I don't know. And maybe even framing it with such either-or terms helps bring it on. Knowing what we know, having these events in front of us, what does it mean to be a people of integrity? What does it mean to know that these things are wrong and go on about living our lives as we are used to living them? How are we to keep fresh and act on our good intent? I'm not going to chastise anybody for not acting on it. I'm right in there with you because I don't know the answer. Howard Thurman says, there's no intent to betray what seemed so sure at the time, but little by little, there crept into life the dust and grit of the journey. Details, lower level demands, all kinds of cross currents, nothing momentous, nothing overwhelming, nothing flagrant, just day-to-day life. Wear and tear got in the way. So how are we to resolve to keep fresh? How are we going to do it? Enough of this behind the pulpit, seriously, because you're sitting there looking for the pulpit or for Martin Luther King to tell you how to do it, right? The Savior. I don't have it. I don't know. I've sat with this. I've tried to live it, and I don't know. I don't know how to keep fresh my resolve in front of me. Maybe somebody in here does, but I can tell you every year, whenever we talk about every cause, we all have the sense of we want it to be different. And then what do? We go back to the wear and tear of our daily lives. How might we resolve to keep fresh, keep it alive? The problem shared by all of us, as bothered as we are by the injustice we see around us, we too easily fall back, but we just fall back into our personal focus and comfort. Please inspire me out of that. I can't do it. I can't do it. Sharon Welch, in A Feminist Ethic of Risk, calls it middle-class despair. We're moved by words, but because we can't be sure our actions will make a difference and be dramatic, we tend not to do anything because we say it doesn't make a difference. We talk about it a lot. It's actually the result of living with this awareness of so much power and privilege all around us that we then feel helpless, even though we are the benefactors of the power and privilege. And she suggests that rather than being controlled by an ethic of control and comfort, we might take on an ethic of risk. Before you go, yeah, right, hang in there with me. It's kind of a little easy shift to get you into just thinking about what you might do different. She says, an ethic of risk that knows loss and vulnerability but does not give loss and despair the last word. It challenges us to live creatively, live, be alive, with the disjunction between the clarity of our moral imperatives, justice, peace, equality, and the ambiguity of our efforts to implement those details. She summarizes with a helpful, useful image. She suggests that this ethic takes us far, and my apologies to those in AA, because I'm not critiquing this next prayer, I'm just saying it in this example. This ethic takes us far from the comfortable prayer of Reinhold Niebuhr. God, grant me the courage to change what I can, the serenity to accept what I cannot change, and the wisdom to know the difference. She says, the drive of moral life is that we can never know the difference between that which we can change and that which we cannot. So our challenge is to move creatively in a very different sort of adventure, one whose prayer is more like this. What improbable task, with which unpredictable results, shall we undertake today? Doesn't that feel different? And you wake up and say, I'm going to do that and just see what I can do. We can't undo the past or control the future, Welch says, but we can learn from the past and we can live creatively, responsibly, and compassionately in the present. That's our challenge. How do we do that? We've been asking that question. We can live creatively. It's the language of fresh, and it's the language of being alive. Keep fresh before me. Another idea I got as I was thinking about this is going back to our notion of hospitality, meeting people where they are with what we have to offer. Creative, being creative, moving out from our sense of security. Hospitality requires what we said last week, that we are comfortable, and I know there's that word, but we are comfortable enough in our sense of self to be in conversation. So we can know ourselves well enough to reach out to the other. We can be open. We can hear the other. We can make mistakes and not get defensive. Retreat into what? Our comfort, our knowing, our middle class despair. If we don't get defensive, we can reach out. Stay open. Keep our home and minds open. Meet others where they are. You also think about keep fresh. You fix up your house before you have company. You know, you kind of put the energy into it and make the difference. What do we have to offer? I'm not sure. But we do have a willingness to keep trying. We have a community of inclusive intent, good intent, with a restless conscience trying to discover what is right. We have a commitment to stay awake. So we emphasize, keep fresh before me. What does fresh mean? It means keep it in my care. Keep it growing. Keep it alive. I received a poinsettia as a Christmas present. It's bright and beautiful and in my awareness during Christmas. Now it's really hard to remember to water it and to take off the dead leaves, seriously, and to take off the dead leaves and to hope that I can make it survive until next Christmas. How many of you threw your poinsettia away? Just a little metaphor action going on there that I thought about when I was doing it. Keep fresh before me the moments of my high resolve. Keep it in my care. So maybe that ethic of risk is something we could try. What did she say? What improbable task, with which unpredictable results, shall we undertake today? That gives us the freedom to think and try and come with excitement rather than be defensive and to make a difference in the world. Keep fresh before me the moments of my high resolve, where high means where I care, where I connect, where I love, where I know it's important. We've gone over time, but what I wanted to do and what I think we should do as a congregation or as a community is make space for coming up with our, and it's not ideas, but our ways of keeping our thinking alive. Does that make sense? You know, it's sort of not a special program, but maybe a program will grow out of that. But how do we keep our commitment alive and go beyond the words of the day? How are we to be a people of integrity? In this year, where it's become so obvious that so much has changed, but it hasn't changed at the level where you can sit back and go, civil rights, done deal, I'm on to other things. We have to be involved and connected. So how are we going to do that? New moment, I hope, fresh resolve.